Hello, everybody. Thank you for joining the Great Dynamics podcast. My name is Ahmed Hassan. And today we have, I think, one of my favorite guests back with us, Gareth Westworth. Gareth is at the moment the Associate Director and Head of Global Intelligence at Cyberline. And his previous role when he did the last podcast was he was the Senior Intelligence Manager and set up the team at AstraZeneca. And today we're going to talk about a lot about intelligence management, about setting up teams, training people. And I will give the word now to Gareth. Gareth, thank you for joining us.
Well, Ahmed, thank you so much for having me back on. And just a quick bravo from me for your success.
Cheers.
I know it wasn't quite nascent when we last spoke, but the podcast has certainly seemed to have exploded in popularity and reach. And I've listened to quite a few of the previous episodes. Really great stuff. So thank you for what you're doing for the community and sector.
Thank you so much. That's really nice to hear. And I think when we did it the last time, I didn't really know what the direction of the podcast was going to be in. And looking at it now, I think me personally, that a lot of people in the community, professional intelligence professionals, are listening to it and reaching out is, for me, the biggest compliment. Even though we did it for people that are interested in getting into it and the larger public or wider public, but to hear from your peers, that's, I think, the most important. So to get positive feedback from peers and also having access or having able to access people from outside of the Anglo-Saxon sphere and them to come on is being really good. And I really want to talk to you about today about your experiences in setting up teams and building teams and managing teams. So before we get into that, did you have any announcements or things that you wanted to get off your chest before we get into that?
So again, thank you so much for having me on. And I know you sent some idea of the topics we're talking about via message. And it's really been about a bit of a checkered job history, but one thing has remained a constant since I kind of began this journey into security intelligence in 2011. The fact that I have pretty consistently either been in new teams, establishing new roles, helping establish new teams, or indeed, you know, building them from scratch. My current role at Cyberline, a risk consulting firm, I look after and oversee, very lucky to look after and oversee a cadre of in-house intelligence analysts that deliver an increasing amount of intelligence to a variety of clients. So I think, you know, the loop has been closed. I've seen, you know, the public sector, but now I've been both in, real company, AstraZeneca, a pharmaceutical company, with, you know, that small global team that often, you know, companies often have these small global teams. And that's why the vendor cadre exists. So now I'm essentially with a vendor, with the service provider, with a much larger team, and I've seen both sides of it. So look, my journey is still continuing, and I'm hoping we can have a conversation and learn from each other here. But I'm always encouraged by the amount of folks that are reaching out, that want to get into the sector. And this is why I think this sort of podcast, this sort of delivery is essential in demystifying what can be a quite confusing landscape, you know. And I will just point to Cyberline's latest monthly newsletter, which is free, goes out on LinkedIn. It's called Insights. And I've actually done an article in there, a thought leadership article, on a very basic introduction to demystifying the private sector, because I think university programs have become increasingly aware of this, but traditionally intelligence programs and security programs at universities have been looking more at public sector, you know, intelligence theory, intelligence failures. And university professors out there, correct me if I'm wrong, please reach out if I am, but there is far less of a focus on actually how intelligence professionals, the intelligence profession, can aid companies writ large in what is an increasingly complicated and volatile world. So again, great props for what you're doing, and I'd encourage anybody to follow Cyberline on LinkedIn and reach out to that article, which hopefully, if they read that and listen to this podcast, you know, will set them up for better insight and success.
Cool. So I think in academia, I think you're right. I will say that maybe I'm a bit biased, but alma mater of Brunel, I think they do a pretty good job, and it's fairly diverse in teaching. But you are right, it's a lot about theoretic intelligence and how that happens. But I think out of everybody, probably they have the strongest focus on how to do it and how the private sector does it. But my first question to you, how do you build an intelligence team? I mean, I kind of broke it down between training structure and thinking, but you can break it down however you want to answer that question.
Yeah, sure. I mean, this is largely dependent on the function. So first of all, you know, you need to identify stakeholders and the stakeholder need, because intelligence, you know, information that's been processed through procedures and assessed is not going to be much good if it's not relevant, accurate and timely and all the rest of it. So one has to, first of all, look at the stakeholders. You know, what do stakeholders want? Do they want strategic analysis on a kind of geographic or regional basis? Are they looking at protective intelligence? Are they looking at tactical intelligence that might, for example, contribute to travel security? Do they want all of the above? Also, you need to look at the problem set that faces them. So, you know, if you've got a stakeholder who is primarily interested in the AFPAC region, for the sake of argument, then maybe you're looking at a problem set which is geared towards political uncertainty, certainly insurgency and terrorism. Whereas if you're looking at other parts of the world, it might be necessary to employ different skills. I mean, my team at Cyberline, I run the global intelligence team. So we have a global remit. So I'll maybe look at my team and then how that differs from other teams within my company. We are split into four desks, so we cover the whole globe. Okay, so we've identified the four kind of overarching regions of the globe. Middle East and Africa is one, Europe, Eurasia is another, Asia Pacific is another, and then the Americas. And then those are in themselves split into two distinct teams. So, for example, in the Americas team, we have North American and Latin American specialists, and our desk leads span both regions. So that's kind of one side of my team, and the other side is then functions that enable that. So we have cyber desk, for example, that whilst producing their own products will assist and help the regional teams when they're approaching topics that have a cyber element, and most topics do these days, you know, whether that be information security, disinformation, or cyber attacks, for example, data leaks, etc. And we have a quality control editorial desk, and then we have a data and insights desk. And, you know, if you're talking about open source intelligence, which is a large part of our kind of sources, we do other stuff as well, but open source intelligence is pretty key. There is such a wealth of data out there that having a dedicated desk to help desks process that data, whether that be crime data and pulling that into a dashboard, or even our own internal KPIs, you know, looking at efficiencies, looking at what our clients like and don't like, you know, that's a real luxury to have that. And because data is such an intrinsic part of what we do now, you know, whether that's measuring our own success or indeed compiling products. The recent Israel-Hamas war, you know, we were able to very quickly use our data desk to work with the Middle East desk in order to pull potential protest activity globally related to Hamas, you know, using social media, scraping tools, etc. So for our team, you know, the regional desks, because our clients have a global regional focus, that's key. So the other important thing I'd say is that, you know, you have different flavors. So most of my team on the regional desk are former academics. They may have some time in industry, but they are regional experts because frankly, it's easier to train, you know, say a junior associate who is an expert in a certain region, say it's Asia Pacific, passionate, has networks in that region, has studied it, has lived there, speaks languages. It's easier to train them, although not completely easy, but it's easier to train them to be an analyst. So take them through structured analytic techniques, which we do. We have a robust training pipeline, how to write, you know, defense writing or intelligence writing. Easier to do that than it is to train them, I don't know, to be Chinese. You can't train that, right? So my team, we have to have regional specialists, cyber specialists, and then those enabling functions that, as the term suggests, enables our regional teams to put out that output. Now, it's very different Okay, so if you're in, for example, my old company, a pharmaceutical company, we had offices all around the world, supply chain nodes all around the world, and we had a very, very small team. So to that end, having somebody who had, you know, PhD in China or has a deep understanding of US policy or those very deep topics wouldn't have been much use if that's all they had. So in that kind of smaller team, you need generalists, okay? So maybe, you know, at the junior end, folks that might have done an intelligence and security degree or have a broader interest in global affairs than just a really narrow interest. So folks that have done international relations, for example, at university, but also possibly people with a bit of experience, because what you're looking for in an in-house team, I'll call it in-house, okay? So I'll refer to any small team or larger team within a what you'd say is a normal company, you know, not an intelligence firm, but a normal company, we'll call that in-house. In an in-house team, really the idea is that these analysts have, first of all, a really good idea of what's going on in the globe. So that when a board member or the chief security officer says, right, I need intelligence on Haiti, you know, because that's kicked off, they can pivot towards that. So as I said, a real global remit there. And what you must also have is the ability to succinctly, concisely reduce very complex topics into the bare minimum. Sometimes, you know, one slide for the board. So in that regard, somebody who, you know, at least leading the team, somebody who's had some experience in industry or the public sector is more useful because they might have pivoted to that before. And, you know, that really depends on, as I said in the article in the Civiline newsletter, it really depends on the size of the team. So the more you have, the more you can afford maybe to employ more junior members of staff and train them. But that's the key difference, because in an in-house team, you're really an intelligence professional that's an expert in that company. So you then say, you know, well, how do you get the intelligence? Well, that's where companies like, you know, Civiline come in, right? Because we have the regional expertise and then we feed all our Kirby-Swens reporting to the generalists within these in-house companies that can synthesize all of that, that can take in large amounts of data and make it relevant to the company. So, you know, in all intelligence professions, it's necessary to be able to take in and sift large amounts of data, but especially if you're in a small global in-house company, it's really important that you're able to synthesize all of this reporting that you're getting from vendors. You might have more than one, and then crucially be able to identify the business need and translate that. So, you know, in the private sector, those are the two broad categories I used in the article, you know, vendors versus in-house teams. And also there's a space, obviously, where sometimes the chief security officer doesn't necessarily have their own resource and budget to staff an intelligence team, but they have got resource and budget to contract it out. So another thing that we do at Civiline is recruit and train and fulfill embedded contracts. You know, so that's a very similar premise to the in-house example, where you fill a team with the necessary generalists with the necessary skills. So, you know, global analysts, they might have skills in protective intelligence, again, depending on what the stakeholder needs. But I think that's a quite clear distinction there between the two types of team that I've helped build or and or manage over the last few years.
Thank you so much. Even myself, I didn't understand a lot of the differences because we at Great Dynamics, we've never done the embedding role. We've always operated as a vendor, as you mentioned, as an outside vendor. So that's something I think really good to know. My next question to you is, I mean, you talked about the importance of data and using tools to understand and to get insights from that data and collate it as it were. And we're seeing the role of especially generative AI rising. How do you think that impacts teams? Does it empower? Does it conflict? And what could it do for an intelligence team like yours, for example?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So I think data doesn't answer questions, but data gives you the right questions with which to answer. There will always be that human element, for example. So I look at data, even internal data on our analysts, you know, looking at our various desks, the performance of our products and et cetera. And if there's a spike in a particular area, that doesn't answer a question. That gives you the question to answer, because the question is then the so what and the why. And that's why I think humans will always be in the loop even more so, actually, as AI and data analysis proliferates, because the human will always be able to have that context and answer the so what. That's my view anyway, because I'm an intelligence professional and I'm a human, so I'm probably therefore biased. But there you go. So
fair enough.
Data gives you the questions to answer, and the ability to pull that data gives you the right questions, as I just iterated, rather than scratching around in the dark. It can actually focus one's mind on answering the questions that are really important. I often get questions on, you know, why is this trend occurring when it's not really occurring? It's an anecdote, you know, so somebody has picked up on an anecdotal trend, but you look at the data and actually it's not a trend at all, or it's in keeping with seasonal norms. So you can very quickly, as I said, elucidate what is actually weird to look, you know, weird to analyze, because intelligence can sometimes be intelligence and risk analysis can sometimes be like looking down a straw, okay? And, you know, you've got a huge palette of risk, the risk landscape to pick from. And sometimes often data can help you point that straw in the right place, but it'll always take a human to kind of look through it to extend the analogy. AI, that's an interesting one. Okay, AI does not have the answer yet, but we use, our Datadesk uses AI and machine learning, for example, to develop, we're currently starting to develop polling aggregation for elections. Not because we're an election polling service, but because there are certain policy and risk implications to outcomes that we want to then give you an idea of what the outcome might be. We used AI machine learning to look at predicted protests. We use it to model strike data. And we, for the Israel Hamas, we even had a model where we could predict with a quite high level of certainty which parts of that particular country would be targeted in the next 24 hours. Not necessarily hit, but targeted. Don't ask me how my lead data analyst did. I have no idea. But he did.
Fascinating.
And it was very impressive. So an AI, I think, will have a role to play. And this is, I'm quite passionate about this. Ahmed, if we can step back to the intelligence cycle, direction, collection, analysis, and dissemination, you know, kind of broadly, you can have 5 steps, 6 steps, but let's just take 4 steps. Now, me and my senior management in the global intelligence team at Civilion spend a lot of time on the first one, direction, as do our relationship branch. So a chief security officer may have a question that they need to answer, and there may not be enough time for them to sit down and refine it into some, you know, priority intelligence requirements and then some supplemental intelligence requirements and essential elements of information. So direction is important. That's kind of what your seniors will do, really. And then, you know, what we get paid for is dissemination, essentially. And, you know, whether a client or a partner chooses to listen to us or indeed invest in us is dependent on number 3. And that's the most important, analysis. So getting the information, analyzing it, putting it through structured analytic techniques, putting it in context, assessing its credibility, its reliability, then making a qualitative or sometimes quantitative assessment, which is, you know, based on probabilistic language, outcomes, courses of action, etc. We all know the nomenclature. However, what do we spend most of our time doing? Number 2, collection. We spend all of our time doing that. And we're not, you know, that takes up, I mean, you could call it the research, okay? But the collecting of information, you take up all the time doing that. Now, even in the public sector, you know, where you have automated collection facilities, etc., you're still collecting, right? So if you're trying to make an assessment, you're still collecting the various reporting that you need to make that assessment, okay? So sure, you know, the collection's already been done. Some agent handler has gone out, met the reform, and there's a report about it. But if you're trying to make a broad assessment about the disposition of a terrorist group in a certain country, you're putting on all those reports, you're putting your Boolean logic into your various reporting tools. So you're still collecting and then reading the information. You're still collecting it, right? You're not at that stage doing any analysis. You're just trying to get all the reports in front of you that could help you answer the intelligence question. AI could play a role there. You know, imagine a world in which you could plug in all of your data sources, your internal feeds, you know, any reporting that you might have done, for example, Great Dynamics, any OSINT, any subscriptions that you might have. Also data, right? So if you have one of these incident tracking tools, which gives you, you know, hundreds of thousands of dots on a map per month, plug that in. What if you've got a social media scraping tool? Plug that in. Anything you want into one pane of glass that could then extract entities, for example. So, you know, if I'm looking at the outcome of the US election on policy towards Venezuela. If you could do that and something could pull out the most relevant reporting, even give you a bit of a summary, okay, and then link you to the most relevant reports. So, you know, your collection time goes down dramatically. It goes down dramatically. That's the thing with AI. That's one example. That's not the DS solution. But that's one example of, for example, where AI could potentially play a role. Where it's not going to play a role is writing reports. and actually producing the end product and making the assessment, you know. Well, I say that we've seen alleged, you know, strikes in the Middle East that have reportedly done that, you know, used AI as a solution. And, you know, from my public sector experience, I can imagine how that happened. There are certainly tools out there. But AI will, I think, again, get you, just like the data analysis piece, to answering the right questions. And then it's the human that will actually answer them. You know, you're not going to rely on AI to recommend travel security advice to, you know, a client that's potentially going to a very dangerous part of the world. You'd always need to proof it. You would always need to proof that. And also, can you rely on AI to source credibility and bias? Potentially. And that's absolutely key as well. You can engineer it all you want, but I would not personally, and maybe I'm being a bit old-fashioned here, or a Luddite, I would never trust AI to give me the final answer on source reliability, source credibility. I'd always want AI to tell me, you know, there, it's almost like having a huge bank of research analysts that can work very, very quickly. Give me what, you know, the machine thinks the assessment is, what the solutions are, what the sources are, and then the human proofs that and contextualizes it. We're talking about an in-house team. I would never trust AI to fully know what my board or my chief security officer actually wants, because I've spoken with we've had conversations. I get the cut of their jib. I know what they need. Now, I could plug all of my company information into AI and they can give me a really, really quick answer of, you know, these are the factors that will affect your supply chain. But I would never just get that off, because I'd always want to put that in context myself, because of that informal interaction I would have had with my stakeholders and that feeling. I know them. I know my stakeholders, my clients, in a way that AI just simply can't, in my view. As I said, I will likely have a lot of pushback and possibly hate mail on LinkedIn from our tech-savvy friends. But I embrace it. You know, I push very hard in my company to get a data and insights desk that uses AI and machine learning models. So I'm not this, and I fully embrace the value of technology, data, AI, be that generative or machine learning. But I think, you know, there'll always be human in the loop, and even more humans in the loop.
Absolutely. I agree with you. I agree with you completely. I found it funny that a couple of months ago, somebody reached out to me on LinkedIn and said, hey, do you guys sell access? Do you have an API that gives us access to your old reports that we could use to train an AI? And I was like, no, we don't have that. And two, I might as well just do it for ourselves, you know, instead of a third party. But I thought it was fascinating that they asked that. Something you mentioned that it kind of blew my mind from another industry learning, but I wanted to know before I talk about my experiences, I would like to hear from you something you just mentioned, and I was going to ask it, but what does the process look like of understanding stakeholder requirements? Is that systematic? Is that a conversation? Is that an RFI document? You know, how does that work for you?
I think that's a really good question. And without doubt, that's the hardest bit in the intelligence cycle direction. Because, you know, we've all been there whereby there's a somewhat vague question asked by stakeholder and a team tries to answer it without refining it. And then it turns out it doesn't hit the mark. And you end up, one ends up doing, you know, 5-6 versions of a report before it hits the mark. And that's inefficient and you've wasted a lot of time. So you can't always expect a stakeholder to really understand what they know. That's why they're asking you. They don't know what they don't know. However, there are certain techniques you can use. So first of all, I'll go through the kind of RFI process and CCIRM and all that good stuff. Essentially, you have, the commander's critical information requirement, or in the private sector now, the client's critical information requirement. It's the same acronym, CCIRM. CCIR, say the M is for management. So what I would then do, I would try to engage with the stakeholder to, at the very least, get priority intelligence requirements, PIRs. So, for example, I want to know what the security situation is like in London. So those are your priority intelligence requirements, okay? So security situation in London at CCIR, the PIRs are then, okay, I want to know about the crime rates. I want to know about terrorism. I want to know about protests and civil unrest. And I want to know about any infrastructure concerns. Now, at that point, that's probably enough. And if the stakeholder doesn't know those priority information intelligence requirements, we can deduce them. However, the danger with that is, of course, having too many and giving the stakeholder information that they might not care about. They might not care. They might want to know about crime. They might not care really about terrorism, or they probably do. But that's probably where I go. From there, then you can go all the way down. Okay, so we can split those priority intelligence requirements internally. So in terms of crime, okay, so what is the crime rate for the past 6 months by district? Where are the main crime hotspots? So the classic, 4 W's. What crime is prevalent? Where are there different trends? Is violent crime more prevalent in this part of London? Is petty crime more prevalent in these parts of London? What crimes have been committed? Where? By who? Who are the main perpetrators? Is there any gang? How? And maybe why? Okay, so that's kind of how you can start breaking it down internally. And I'd say, for even in-house, for any team, try to at least get priority intelligence requirements agreed with your stakeholder, because they might not know them to start with, but you might say, right, so do you want civil unrest? No, I don't want that. But actually, I really care about what security is like on the tube, for example, or whatever. So that's called the kind of CCIRM management, CCIRM process, Commander's Critical Information Requirement Management. And we do that. So at Sibylline, we have quite a robust RFI process. So no matter how vague the ask, we have an internal system that tries to quantify the ask. And of course, it'll be stakeholder-led, but at the point where the chief security officer is just too busy to think about it, using CCIRM actually gets us 90%, 99% there, I'd say, but always engaging. The second thing is, you can, and this goes into another common question, is how do you measure success, right? Because it's really important to measure success in the intelligence and security team, because if you do everything right, nothing happens. But the same rules can apply to, understanding stakeholders. So do you have a tool within your company or your team that can look at when reports are opened? So even a basic, I think, SharePoint does that. We have other systems, but you're not spying on your stakeholders. You're just looking at what reports are being opened.
We do the same, yeah.
So at that point, you then maybe start tagging all of your reports, okay? So we have a system whereby all our reports are tagged with region, country, strategic risk, and a variety of other things. So we can have a look at what's actually trending. We can see, well, stakeholders really, clients are really concerned about this issue at the minute. They're opening and clicking through all of the reports that we do. So, the open rate for these reports is 20% higher than the average. How about we do more of this? How about we do a webinar on it? Let's connect with our clients, Similarly, we push out a load of reporting and it doesn't get any opens. We're like, well, there's a million things we can report on in the world. This isn't hitting the mark. We think it's important, but our clients don't at the moment. We'll keep monitoring it, but we won't waste client inboxes with spamming them with this. Maybe we'll reduce the frequency. We'll do a webinar on it, maybe, or a podcast, and then we might do a special report once in a while because it's important, but clearly, a weekly report on this isn't necessary because clients aren't opening. Or maybe I'll go further to say, this is important. Why aren't clients noticing this? So we'll push it out publicly. We might do something on it. So clients are aware of it. There's a number of things you can do at that point. And then this is, we go back to the data piece. It's all about asking the why with that. Okay, so why is this being engaged with or not engaged? But the first step, as I said, look at the tools within your IT stack, and they don't have to be very sophisticated. As I said, SharePoint, I think, does this. Look at what's been opened, look at what's being clicked on. And then finally, kind of client feedback or stakeholder feedback.
Uh-huh.
So huge. This can range from a survey, a quarterly survey. And I always say, if I'm trying to assess the usefulness of a particular product, I always give three choices, not five. It becomes unwieldy then. Was it critical, useful, or interesting? So interesting is like, yeah, nice to have. Useful was, yeah, we do use this periodically. Critical is like, I cannot operate my security function or whatever function it is without this report. Do you have tools with which you can put that at the bottom of each report so they can click on it, for example? So at the bottom, they can click on one, two, or three. And if they don't click on it, it's probably a one. those are ways that you can. So the one way is being proactive with your CCIRM and making sure that you manage your priority intelligence requirements and quantify the question. Hopefully get it from an open question to a closed question. And there's a whole, I know MOD do an analysis guide on this. There's a whole thing in there. We do training as well. We look at the direction phase of the intelligence cycle. But then, of course, there's then the retrospective piece about looking at what is hitting the mark. And as I said, anecdotal feedback is great. But if you do have the facility to look at what reports are opened, that's not a bad start. Although we do something far more sophisticated at Citiline that I could go into for a whole hour, but we'll maybe save that for another time.
Yeah.
Does that answer the question, Ahmed?
Yeah, absolutely. The only follow-up that I would ask would be, when you're designing the commander's critical information requirement, is that a conversation live or is that a back and forth sending and returning?
Yeah, so typically, it really does depend on the stakeholder, because I wouldn't spam a really busy CSO that I know was a one-person band, a massive company, maybe a new, it's a new position, and working 27 hours a day. I'd be sympathetic to that and maybe go, okay, this question, I know the stakeholder, we've got a really vague question here, but I think we can pass it out and I think I know what they want. But typically, for example, in our setting, we might have a client or customer or just, somebody new to the company who reaches out to us maybe after a podcast or something and goes, hey, I want to know this. So Platinum solution is that it is detailed and precise enough that we can pretty much get started. We clarify a deadline, all the rest. But if not, what I do, I'd work very closely with the relationship branch at the company, which is another branch within Citiline, to try to understand the needs. Now, the relationship branch, as the name suggests, will have a good relationship with stakeholders. So it might be that, our head of relationship branch knows this person and goes, well, Gareth, they probably want this, that, and the other. A, B, and C. I know them. Let's not bother them. Or it may just be an email going back to the stakeholder and going, okay, do you have any further information on what you really need? And if it's a no, maybe one more try where I actually suggest what they could want. And that can sometimes then kind of generate some ideas and kind of turn on the gray matter to the question. And they might then go, yes, that's exactly what I need. Or actually, as I was saying in the last answer, no, we don't need that, but we need that. We don't need A, but we need B. If after that, there's still kind of radio silence or the stakeholder's still not quite sure, as I suggested in the last answer, we just go ahead then and try and pass it out for ourselves, which we're pretty good at. But absolutely, it's that balance. One never wants to overburden. And same as if you're in-house, right? If you got a question from the CSO or the board, you don't want to be going back and forth the board all the time. It's your job as the intelligence professional in that company to have a good idea of the stakeholder. And that means forming prior relationships, okay, that you pretty much know what they want. And in the in-house example, it has to be absolutely relevant to the business, right? So it's a combination. And, this is the other thing I wanted to, maybe point out. It's all about creating relationships, especially if you're in-house or embedded, for example. But even in my team, so I have relationships with the stakeholders to understand their needs.
Understood. The reason why I asked is because we had a conversation with an agency that was actually not doing intelligence, but we're building a new platform. So I think that's probably, we're going to launch that at the end of the month, beginning of next month. And they had a very systematic approach of almost a gamified system of them understanding our wants and needs and how they should implement that, and making it so narrow enough that it will not be too much, but that they understand, all right, what are the four or three most important things to you that you want to get out of this? And when we saw that, me and our more technical marketing person, we looked at each other and said, hey, why are we not doing that for our clients? Because it would help us understand. So this is something that we can learn from other industries that are, I think, better developed, especially when it comes to, you know, the relationship management part of things.
Yeah, and this slightly straying outside of my domain here, but I'd be inclined to agree. You know, I've onboarded several kind of SaaS solutions when I was at my last place and even now. And yeah, software, you know, they have to be that prescriptive because there's such a monetary investment on their side. If they get it wrong, they have to rebuild it. And if, you know, if they get it wrong and they don't absolutely nail down what you want in writing and it doesn't quite meet your needs, they have to wipe it all and start again, which could be hugely financially impactive. And so I think there is something we can learn that from there. And our relationship folks are really good at establishing that. And we often in the intelligence team get a really good steer as to, you know, what's important to this client and this stakeholder. But it is the case that, you know, at times when it comes to tailored projects, if there's a huge world event of geopolitical importance, a board is breathing down chief security officer's neck for answers. And, you know, sometimes the CSO doesn't have time to really pass it out in his head or her head. And time could be of the essence. You know, what we don't have in our world, Ahmed, is the luxury of time that those selling solutions do. Sometimes they want something, for goodness sake, I've got a meeting.
Overnight.
Tomorrow. I've never even heard of this country where there's now a war, you know, and I need something quick. And so that's why I say it would be the key difference here. But I agree with the general premise that we, you know, we can learn and take some stock for kind of our business development colleagues when trying to manage the direction phase of the intelligence cycle.
Absolutely. So my next question is about what makes a good intelligence leader, commander, manager, in your opinion?
Okay, now I'm going to answer the question not because I believe I'm the finished product at all. No.
I think you're very near there, so that's why I ask you.
I appreciate it. And I appreciate the implied compliments by your question. I think, listen, I'll just do a bit of a throat clearing here. I've done a lot of, as you'll see from my resume and LinkedIn, I've had a lot of different roles, a lot of different bosses, and have, you know, as I said, in some guise or another, even when a relatively junior member of staff, had to create these platforms. Now I am a manager in intelligence function, and it's almost like, you know, that cadence, that almost crescendo to where I am at the moment. I'm very privileged to be in the position I am. Now, unfortunately, there's the adage that I think everyone sees on social media that we get trained to the nth degree to be good practitioners. You know, if you're in the UK, you might do in the public sector, you might do the GIAT or the DIAM or the other four-letter acronyms, which are basically your versions of the similar thing, training you had to do. Intelligence, when I was in the military, you know, you'd have months and months of training on writing, on structural analytic techniques, on briefing, on various doctrines. Then you become a good practitioner, and after a while, you start managing. And whilst there are management courses out there, it's very rare that you get trained. If you're in the military, you do get trained. So, you know, if you're promoting from a junior NCO to a senior NCO, you get leadership training. You get leadership training at Sandhurst if you're going to be an officer, and then you have training at Staff College, you know. So the military do it reasonably well. I don't know what the rest of government do. You know, if you go from being a practitioner to more of a manager, if there's training there, I'm sure there is, but I don't. But in the private sector, it's not necessarily mandated. So often, good practitioners just become managers. And that sometimes works.
Sometimes.
I certainly hope in my case it's worked. So what do I think it takes? Okay, so everyone's got a different management style, it seems. I think the one advantage of being a former practitioner is that you have empathy. Now, empathy is really important. Having spent a day, or in my case, 13 years, in the shoes of those under, who you hate using the word command, manage, that's the better word, oversee and manage. So that's worked for me. And all I can say here is what has worked for me and what hasn't worked for me. Okay, it might be different for everyone, and I'm certainly not a management expert or management consultant. So empathy is one. You need to position yourself. It's hard to position yourself whether to punch up and punch down, if that makes sense. And it's a hard line to tread. So especially if you're a senior manager, so I have to and do have my company's best interests at heart. And then I also have the interests of all of the staff whom I oversee at heart as well. And hopefully both are aligned. But conceptually, one can see how the needs of a company may not always square with the needs of the individual. As I said, in my case, I've been very lucky that Sibylline, the needs of the individual are the needs of the company, very people-orientated business. But one can see when that's, when that can be an issue. If there is a need, but it can't be met by the company for budgetary reasons, for example, like hypothetically. So having empathy, but being able to step back and look at the needs of the individual and the company and balance them and compromise, I can imagine that's one of the harder things to do. Especially if, like me, you're a people person, you care about people. And as I said, it really does help if the culture of the company that you're in is people-oriented, which we are. Technically, the ability to step away and delegate, and that has been very, very difficult. Pushing on levers and then leaving it, not because one doesn't trust the folks that are doing it, because one feels, as a former practitioner, I have to get involved here. Have to get my hands dirty, because that's what leadership is. It's leading from the front. You see the pictures of those those allergies. I mean, the managers at the back whipping folks to go forward, but the leaders at the front pulling them. I think people can take that a bit too literally and go down rabbit holes. And especially in a more senior position where you're seeing a quite substantial capability, to be able to step back, know that delegation isn't shirking responsibility. And it's absolutely necessary in order for the manager, the leader, to have strategic clarity. So, of course, there will always be times where you have to really get in there. And certainly as we've been growing, there's times where demand has outstripped supply. And I've gone in to edit some reports, for example. there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong, especially in a growing company. Or if you're in-house, there's three of you. And not 30, it's 3D. Yeah, getting your hands dirty, that's not a bad thing. But doing that at the expense of your job, which is to have that strategic clarity and make decisions that will better help the team achieve their goals. So, and that goes into micromanaging as well. Micromanaging is just a slippery slope. I see it, hear about it anecdotally an awful lot. And that is, of course, when one's been a former practitioner, that's very easy to do. So this is, not a slight on anybody who has a proclivity to that, especially those relatively new to management. Because, again, we're practitioners. Just in the same way, we want to get our hands dirty. If we're not getting our hands dirty, we at least want to be there every step of the way. So that's about trusting folks. And then that goes into then another kind of quite technical aspect of it. I've done a load of recruiting. Over the last, especially the last 18 months. I think I've given 18 young people jobs, which means we have hundreds of applications for each role. So just do that, the math, and think of how many interviews and CVs I've seen, resumes I've seen. I'm, of course, supported by a wonderful team, including my kind of global intelligence manager, my right-hand one, Liana Semchuk, who's been really great, as well as our cracking HR department as well, people branch. But yeah, recruiting is hard because I think you need to recruit as a leader, a manager, as opposed to a former practitioner. But they all need to come to play. So one of the advantages of being a former practitioner is that, you can imagine working with this individual. And that's key because, they need to be able to fit into your company's culture and the team's culture, etc. But, being able to recruit dispassionately based on the teams and companies' needs. And it's almost like writing an intelligence report, right, in-house for a company. You're not writing about the objective situation. You're writing about how this situation would affect the team, would affect the company. And you're recruiting for what fits best at the time to advance your team and your company's goals. And I didn't really get that at the start, but I've got more used to that now. So those are some things. And finally, it's a passion. The intelligence profession, you need passionate people. People with the ability to be objective, with the ability to separate themselves from their worldview, their politics, and write objectively and discompassionately, right? But you need to have a passion for your subject matter. You need to want to get the best assessment out there. So that's a passion for your company, a passion for your region, a passion for your art or science, however we want to coin it. One of the more difficult things, well, yeah, there's been some difficult junctures along the way, but hopefully I've learned from them. And of course, personnel issues is always really difficult, especially if you're a people person. I always want to, you know, make sure everyone's happy and please people. But there are times when, you know, I guess the needs of the individual don't quite square with the needs of the company from a personnel point of view. So I'll probably leave that one there. But, you know, it for those folks who are just going into it, it's not all roses. And attention to detail, keep it on top of budgets as well, the more boring side of it, I guess. But yeah, I mean, Hamid, you must have some a lot more insight as well, because you've obviously started your own company. So I'm not sure if any of that rings true with you.
It does. I think there's something I wanted to ask, but, you know, I will go into it on my end. I think one of the most, not hardest, I think, but important aspects of management that I, in the intelligence sector, that I think it's for everybody, but especially if you're a small team, as you mentioned, I think is culture. And you are the one who kind of guards and makes sure that the culture is there, the company culture, the culture of how you do things, and, you know, that combined. I mean, people call it maybe vision, you know, but this is an internal thing. So I would say culture has been big. And I think there have been times that I kind of slightly a little bit too hands off with that. And if you cannot instill that in your chief of staff or your operations manager, whomever that role is, and that's something that goes down the chain and everybody understands, and this is how we do things. And you mentioned recruiting. I think that's the number one. How you recruit will impact your culture. And I think, so that's been for me a big one. And I think also understanding what your limitations are individually as a team, as well as a company, and using that as a driver to deliver for your clients. And I think for too long of a time, I tried to compete on things that I think was just silly to compete on. And I think I've mentioned this in a previous podcast, but mainly focusing on what we can deliver better or more efficiently than the next. And I was like, you know what, if everybody's going after, I mean, you mentioned this before the podcast, but if everybody's looking right, you know, see what's out there on the left. Not talking about politics here, but yeah, I think that's what I would say right now today, if you ask me, because I've seen you guys have been doing a lot of great work on this too, which is your publications, your reports that are outward facing, that are not necessarily for your inward clients, but for the general audience and for people that are interested in what Sibylline is doing. I think that's one of the most important, easiest ways to convey your culture and what's important to you guys, and also give a platform to your team to express themselves. And that has been something, because we couldn't maybe compete on certain things, that we were able to give people the platform, the team, to show their skill set, their passions, as you mentioned. And I think overall, from day to day, I agree with you a lot. We talked about AI. I think that has been a bit of a challenge, looking at making sure that people don't use it irresponsibly. of which we had an incident that, you know, didn't really end well. And luckily, it didn't affect any operations or a client, because we use also tools to scan our documents, and I think as everybody should. And yeah, so I think from that perspective, I would say that. And if it's from starting your own company, or, you know, launching a function within a company, you want to convince the management that you need an intelligence function, maybe that's a little bit different. I think you can answer a little bit better on that. But if you want to start something on your own, I would say absolutely the most important thing is endurance. And again, we go back to this thing of vision and culture. That's how you attract people to come on board and also believe in the same as you do, where in the beginning, maybe you cannot even pay people when you start out. So that's, I think, very important. Try to be efficient. Try to use technology to your advantage, because you're flexible. You don't have these legacy systems that you have to use, or because you're a big company, and, you know, use that to your advantage to punch above your weight. And understand that, as you mentioned, intelligence is a people profession, and it's not necessarily scalable as such, unless you know, want to hire a lot more people. And that's the inherent conundrum of intelligence at the moment, at least. And so if you want to, like, get rich quick, I wouldn't choose this profession. You know, you have to be really interested, and you can make a good living, but yeah, you're not creating a unicorn as such, I think. And maybe there will be, but it's just from my own experience, I don't see that happening. Maybe I'm just not smart enough for that, to pull that off. But I think that's what I would say. And probably I can do a whole podcast on systematically how to set it up, you know, from, you know, what type of company structure and legal, man. I do know one thing that, and I've mentioned this in multiple podcasts, I mentioned this the last time you and I talked. I think our industry, because of, especially if you came from government, and there's more and more people that don't go the government route now, especially thanks to the OSINT community, you know, that has thrived. I think using the online market, the online platforms, social media, to your advantage to get to punch above your weight, to get seen and get clients, really. Because I think when I started out, nobody was thinking about using the internet to get clients, really. You know, and when we wrote reports at the beginning, people were like, why are you doing that? You know, it's a waste of time. Where I think that kind of changed.
Yeah, the internet is absolutely crucial. And, you know, it goes into the culture piece as well. You know, our CEO and founder, Justin Crump, has an inherent desire to do this properly, this thing we call risk intelligence, do it properly and get it out to people. Okay. And the culture is very much get it out, get stuff out to people first, and consider business kind of commercial stuff later. All right. And in many respects, I'm not concerned with the commercial aspect of it, because my job is to run a team that provides quality risk intelligence. So you saw that, you know, Ukraine, Israel, Hamas, COVID, we push stuff out just, I'll be fine for free, you know, and ask questions later, because we believe that getting the right information to the right people at the right time is what we are here for, and what gives us so much reward. You know, we have clients that absolutely rely on some of our operational reports, whether that be in Ukraine or Israel, Hamas or elsewhere. You know, when Haiti kicked off, we had folks reaching out to us immediately. So our culture is very much right. You know, our clients and our friends and our partners need us. They need the information. We, you know, many of us know what it's like, because we've been client side or we've been in the public sector. And that's really the culture. You know, it isn't a business development culture within the team. Of course, I get visibility of the more commercial aspects of it, and that's just for information, so we can you know, better serve our clients, frankly, you know. But at the analyst level, the culture is very much, get it out there, you know, and ask questions later. So we've seen that. And yeah, I think right, that the space that we're in now, you just go into LinkedIn, for example, and, you know, it's, you can see almost it's ubiquitous. Companies like Sibylline, such as us, pushing stuff out. And I'd like to think that folks that do that aren't just doing it so their business development team's going to, you know, hassle you until the day you die. I hope it's like us. It's a genuine ambition to go, right, this is the information. This is really important. This is really well written, by the way. And you should read this if you care about Venezuelan Guyana. Or, you know, if you care about the coup in Gabon, for example, or, you know, US sanctions in LATAM, the commercial aspects are secondary, tertiary, even below that. And of course, there's, you know, highlighting our successes also. I mean, it's very, very bizarre. It was very bizarre to me coming out of what was a quite closed world when I was operating the public sector, to then kind of advertising one's successes. But, you know, insofar as we can do, we like to promote our folks, the very hardworking, diligent team that produces this. But yeah, first and foremost, it's a culture of, you know, this is what you need to know. And that's increasing online. And look, if somebody reaches out and they like what we do and they want to see more of it,
bonus.
Happy days. But my job, you know, and that's very important, I think, and it must be very, very difficult in a position like yourself whereby you have to, you know, commercial concerns need to be probably more front of mind than they are for me. And as I said, as a kind of an associate director, I need to keep a hand in across all the company and have visibility, really. And, you know, our senior leadership team's really good at doing that, sharing the love so we all understand where we are, frankly. But very happy and content that my main concern is getting the right information, quality intelligence, not just information, quality intelligence, assessment and insight to the right people at the right time. And that's what keeps me awake at night. And indeed, if I do manage to get the sleep, wakes me up in the morning.
Fair enough. So I think, I mean, we could talk about this for hours, but I think we got to the point in the podcast that, as I mean, you've been so gracious to do this before, but what advice would you give, not to people that are trying to get into intelligence or not necessarily analysts, but advice would you give to managers and leaders?
Okay, so if you're a really good, successful manager, a great leader, the advice I'd give is please reach out to me and tell me your secret. share some of that corporate knowledge with me, please. Okay, so I think folks just getting into management, which is probably where I best sit in terms of giving advice. First of all, do reading and seek some training. I started reading ILM stuff and management kind of philosophy. I started reading all too late, okay? Whether it's online or trying to get some books. I think too late. I took the job and I didn't have plenty of time. I was getting rocket attacked in Afghanistan on a reasonably regular basis. But between IDF alarms, in the year leading up to, you know, when I took over started the capability at the pharmaceutical company, I should have maybe invested a bit of time in looking at leadership and management. But at that time, I was only going to be the only intelligence guy, to be honest. And it's only after I took on position that we recruited some under me. And then all of a sudden I'm looking after a very large team. So yeah, prepare. I didn't. And I've been trying to find my feet and I think I'm doing okay. But reach out to those in the global intelligence team. They might tell me differently. I don't know. Second thing I'd say is people management is only one part of it. That's the technical part of it, you know, performance appraisals, promotions, you know, proving expenses or recruiting, all of that technical stuff, the performance management. But really be invested in the company. Know whether it's in-house or your Johnny Render, have an idea of the strategic, not even an idea, I'm sorry, have more than an idea. Be intimately au fait with the strategic objectives of your company. Because you're there in order to realize those objectives in the team that you're going to be overseeing. And so long as your team meet the objectives set by your boss, who might be a director or a senior VP or CEO and everything in between, as long as you're realizing their objectives, then you and your team will stay in a job and you will be successful. So knowing the objectives of the company, the department, your CSO, and spending as much time as possible to be completely in that, because everything you do must fit into the strategic objectives of the company. Okay. And sure, you can look at, you know, we talked about how to measure stakeholder interest before, but you know, it even if you've got interest from stakeholders, if the work that your team is doing isn't in line with the company's priorities, then especially in an in-house team, you'll find yourself without funding very quickly, I'd suggest. In intelligence as well, it's probably worth thinking about how you can measure success. So look at the setup of your company, where you are in the company, your contact touch points with even more senior leadership. Look at the tools that your company has, or from a technical standpoint, looking at software, you know, whatever you can do. Look at the whole picture of where your team sits, and start devising strategies to measure success. Okay, slightly easier in a vendor, because success means that you're selling more subscriptions, or you know, you get more clients. But still, internal performance metrics and performance measurements are very, very useful, because they can also help you, you know, establish when you're going to need more resource, for example. So thinking about how you can measure success or otherwise. And then I think what you said about is really key. So either become intimately familiar with the culture of the company and the team, or if there isn't a team, you know, look at the company's culture, their strategic goals, and really think hard about the culture that your team is going to have. And then finally, I guess I've done this organically. I'm naturally a very diplomatic person. I'm all about empowering people for success, celebrating success, and then, you know, rather than punishing failure, asking why. If something isn't going right, you know, what's the why? We're intelligent professionals. What's the so what? That's my style of management. And it seems to have worked, but establish, you know, how are you going to manage? How are you going, if you're a former practitioner, how are you going to ensure that you don't accidentally become a practitioner, just one that's in charge of people, and you actually become not even just a manager, but I guess a leader? And if you've got really good answers to all of those questions, get in touch with me. And again, please give me some advice. But that's if I had all this over again, to do this all over again, that's what I'd probably do. And I do take inspiration from the great managers and leaders around me in the company and in Sibylline, you know, who've been doing this longer than I. And of course, take inspiration from colleagues and friends such as yourself and those in the wider community that have been gracious enough to give me their time over the years.
Fantastic. Thank you. I one thing I would like to add to what you said about asking the why, which I think is fantastic. I haven't had it broken down so eloquently, so thank you for that. But one thing I learned the hard way is that when you speak to your team and you speak to them as the team in the group, the message might not always land with everybody the same. And it might not resonate when they get spoken to, sounds a bit weird, but when the message or when the goal setting is done. And I think it's very important to have moments when you do the one-on-ones. I think that's something I learned a lot from, where people seem to be doing well and their work seemed to be fine. And then we had a conversation and asked the why, what's going on, how are you? And by just having some understanding of where they were and then being able to convey the message personally to them, their productivity skyrocketed. So that's something I would advise on top of what you just said. It's an extension of what you said.
Absolutely, Ed, and I'll just take the time. You know, I mean, it's I'm fully in favor of this and would be conducting it anyway, but our CEO is very much pushing, mandating weekly one-to-ones. So it would be physically impossible to have weekly one-to-ones with all of my team. However, we have a good command structure within the team. Command structure, sorry, sounding military again. You can take them out with the army. But you know, I have my direct reports. I try and ensure a one-to-one each week, and their direct reports are one-to-one each week as well. I know I should really get around more staff more often. So if you're listening to this global intelligence team, sorry. I'll try to speak to Morvie more often. But yeah, you're right. I mean, I have a wider team meeting a bit later today. I'll sort of give some strategic messages. But yeah, I think having that touch point, weekly touch point is very important. And as your team grows, you know, make sure you have a structure whereby somebody can speak with somebody senior. It may not be you, because your team might have grown to the extent that with several managers and you manage them. But ensure, push, mandate that folks have one-to-ones on a weekly basis that aren't, you know, your daily meeting with your desk to discuss analytic priorities, but a one-to-one where you go, right, how are you? We're very lucky in Sibylline. We've got lots of data, and you might have data on productivity, etc. Not you know, I'd highly discourage you use that as a, let's say, baton. I'd rather use that as a steer. But even if you don't have data, looking at your product performance, et cetera, another major data points that could help you ask the right questions, as I said earlier, even if all you got is, you know, you and them talking, I think, how are you? You know, and that might be right. What have you got on your plate in the minute? What are you struggling with? What's keeping you up? What can I do in order to make your life a bit easier? How is your father? How's the new flat doing? How was the wedding on the weekend? Did you have a good time? Obviously, observing boundaries. That one-to-one is important. And, you know, that's where the empathy comes in as well. So ensure that, I don't think anybody can have more than 7 direct reports at once. I think that, you know, to really do it properly. So, you know, as your team grows, ensure that you have a command structure by which, you know, somebody in a junior can have a conversation with somebody more senior on a regular basis, and do it if there's nothing to talk about. It doesn't, you know, you put away half an hour. It doesn't have to be half an hour, and sometimes there will be operational matters to discuss, but always have that time to ask them how they are. And you do that because you care how they are. Like, I care about how all my team are, and you know that whether I speak to them now and then or whether they're a direct report. And if you don't care about how they are, then maybe you should consider the role as a leader or manager.
A different role.
Going to like contracting where you're an individual, you know, augmentee, a consultant. Yeah, you should care about how they are. And you should then take that time on a regular basis to ask them how they are outside of the purely operational setting. So I'd agree with that, Ahmed, and that's a good intervention.
I wanted to ask you a question, something you mentioned. It has come up in the team over the years, and we have never implemented it, but we are now very close to implementing it. But I wanted to ask you a question about that. What is your stance on, because you mentioned, that's what I really like about metrics, about measuring success, measuring output, outcomes, and impact. Do you think it's good to have that within the team, public, that there is a competitive element of like who had the most?
Okay, Pandora's box.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not in favor of that. I think there's probably other leaders, even within my company, that might be in favor of that. You know, if you're in the military, you get told that you're third in your section at the end of the performance appraisal and the top two get promoted. So unlucky, you know, Ranky. I'm deeply not in favor of that, actually. Now, if, caveat, at management level, so for example, if you have, like, I have several desks, as you know, showing individual desks' output of their analysts, for example, so desk lead will be able to see the output of the analyst below them, I think that is warranted, but only from, not as a baton to beat anybody or ranking. That is to go, okay, well, this individual seems to be less productive. Is everything okay? I'll ask them, because they're not forthcoming. Oh, I'll ask them. Oh, one of their parents is unwell and they're in hospital every day. That's why they're less productive. Okay, tell you what, you didn't tell me this because you're conscientious, but actually you should have, because we, as a company, we care about you. Have some time off here. or have this flexibility here. So, and yet, you know, it is from a senior management perspective useful to see productivity rates, etc. But that can become very pernicious very quickly. So because I'm, despite being ex-military, I'm a kind of a warm, pink and fluffy manager that likes to encourage, empower and celebrate success rather than elude failure to encourage. I'd still against that. But again, it's management style and the culture. If that works, excuse me, we were talking about another company earlier, Ahmed, a company that is providing intelligence and you know, anecdotally, I know it has a quite militaristic feel about the company. I don't know. They may well see that as something, you know, kind of a chest pumping, thrusting, militaristic service provider. I don't know. They may or may not. For me, no, it's all about empowering and celebrating, as I said, celebrating successes. And, you know, our analysts, this is why passion, it was one of my key qualities when looking at not only managers, but professionals. And that's a key component across almost all of our team. If you recruit for the right amount of passion, folks will not need to be told that they're worse than a peer for them to want to do more. They're probably doing the best they can at the moment. If they're not doing the very best they can, you've either recruited wrong or there's a reason. In any case, addressing the core underlying reason is probably more helpful than telling them they're doing worse than, you know, John Smith today. It's my view. Don't know if you agree. There's no right or wrong answer. That's just my...
I hear you. I disagree with you. And the only reason why I disagree is because I think maybe it's emphasis, but we emphasize, because it might not be competitiveness with your peers, but competitiveness with yourself, that you want to do better the next time. So we don't penalize based on those results, but we reward based on those results. So it's not something that you're told, hey, that one person is doing better than you, so therefore you need to work harder. That's not how we do it. It's that's maybe my own personal competitiveness.
Employee of the month kind of thing.
Kind of something like that.
I think, reminder, I mean, the only difference we have is that I would make those statistics public to the analysts themselves. And yeah, I would...
Fair enough.
I would therefore, I'd reward those, you know, who, as I said, about three or four times, celebrate that success. And then, yeah, those whom I see were maybe not doing as well as they could do based on their past performance, I'd go to that desk lead and go, might be an issue here. You know, so I think the only difference is that I'd be averse from making that public. But I have been criticized in the past for being very soft and cuddly.
No. I wouldn't say that.
Work.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that about you. I only think because we have such a big online footprint, everybody knows what the numbers of everybody is already. People know how many views they have. People know who produces, you know, and you're right in one sense. It could produce that people focus on something that they believe is successful instead of maybe good. So there are issues with that. There are some people in the team that don't care at all about it, and it doesn't deter them either that they are not, you know, up to top. And I don't, as I said, I don't punish them for it at all. I think Michael, who oversees the team, he is much like you. I think he's in the very same boat as you. He's a big teddy bear in that regard. And I think he disagrees with me in that a little bit. But I've seen that maybe I like that type of personality, that's fueled by that, because I see myself in that person. But I don't penalize anybody for it, because I see it as, you know, me caring about your work and wanting to do better. But again, it's not, hey, you're not doing enough. And one thing that came out about this, it's, even though it's public and they cannot see it, but I can see it, some things that came up is that we saw that some people were they were excellent communicators, they were excellent briefers, and you know, they walked the walk, and then when we looked at their work, it was okay, but then we saw that their output was far less than the ones that were not that strong communicatively. And so we were like, we are rewarding somebody because they are a good communicator, but not necessarily a good analyst, right? So it kind of like swings both ways, but I do see your perspective on it. And this decision that we need to make was more about the team already knows all the metrics about each other. It's just that, would we share that with the wider public? That's maybe too sensitive, but my final question or questions to you is, you know, cultural recommendations. What are you reading? What are you listening to? What are you watching? I see a stack of books behind you.
Right, no, yeah, I see perspective, Ahmed, and you've been really generous with the time. I know we're nearly on 1 hour and a half now, which is...
Haven't even noticed.
I know. How the time flies when you're having fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, so listen, I dip in and out of books. You know, I think the last time we spoke, I was on Risk, a User's Guide, which is a really, really, really great book. There's some recent books of different ilks that I've read. Agent Storm, an absolute page turner. It's by a chap called Morton Storm. It was he was a spy inside Al-Qaeda. Really great book. It's a page turner. Doesn't reflect anything that you or I do on a daily basis whatsoever. But it is absolutely brilliant. Also been looking at The Rise of the Islamic State, a great document on the organization. I've read lots about Islamic State in the past, but the Rise of Islamic State is called, the book somewhere on my shelf behind me, I could get you the author. That's a really, really good account. It's a little bit dated now, but it's a really, really good account. So on leadership, Dame Stella Rimington was the first female director general of the UK Security Service, MI5, and she has a book, again, it's a bit older, called Open Secret. Now, it's a really great account of how, you know, Stella was in a very male-dominated environment when she was recruited by MI5 and worked her way up to be, you know, director general. And for those, especially those women in security, you know, I know we're increasingly now becoming a very inclusive sector, but you know, there were still, no doubt, still issues out there. This is a really great account of somebody who entered a really toxic male environment, as MI5 was when Stella Rimington joined, and how she overcame that to become the very successful Director General. And you know, and another one, finally, one I've read recently, actually, it was written before the most recent Ukraine, it was written before the war. However, it's a great account of Russia and the Russian regime, and it's called Nothing is True and Everything is Possible.
Oh, I love that book.
It's absolutely brilliant.
I love that book.
And, you know, it's I learned about it on another podcast, and my head of Europe Eurasia, who's an absolute Russia expert, was very pleased that I read it. So, yeah, just a couple of ideas there. And yeah, that Open Secret, Stella Rimington, as I said, it's getting on a bit now, but it's still very relevant to those folks wanting to enter a sector that still isn't quite there in terms of inclusivity. But I think it is getting better. As in terms of watching, I've not got much time to watch anything at the minute, Ahmed. So any free time I have is it's non-existent. Taking my dog for a walk and looking after my pet tortoise, and that's probably the
most there you go.
I get, so that's
yeah. I hear you. No, I think you mentioned, I think, Black Flags. Yeah, do you know that book? I think
by Ali Sufar. Yeah, really good. Yeah, he wrote a follow up one as well, didn't he? The name escapes me. But yeah, Ali Sufar, really good writer. And there's some other great ones out there as well. I mean, you know, if you want to be completely and utterly frustrated by the manner in which we exited Afghanistan, read Ghost Wars, because it tells you in a nutshell what's going to happen. And when folks would come to my office in Afghanistan and say, what's going to happen now this thing has been signed, I'd say, read Ghost Wars and compress the timeline. Also, for those of you with a bit of longevity, for slightly drier yet very informative and interesting documents, Director S is almost like the sequel to Ghost Wars. And also a really interesting book, more the public sector side, but for those looking at how, you know, the UK intelligence community interacts with its political masters, there's a book called The Black Door, which is just behind me. Oh, and it would be career suicide not for me to mention Corporate Security Intelligence and Strategic Decision Making, written by my CEO, Justin Crump, which is the go-to resource for any kind of research on private sector intelligence and strategic decision making. So, yeah, those are my recommendations, Arvid.
All right, perfect. I wanted to mention something has not necessarily to do with the book, but a couple of years ago, I wrote an article, I think it was in 2019, about SVR's kind of covert action unit called Zaslon, and it was not a good article. And then I redid it a year later because I got in contact with somebody who knew a lot about them and was able to share with me very interesting details. Some of them came into the new article, which is on Weird Dynamics, if you're interested. And well, we did that article, and then we collaborated with a YouTuber to do a video also on it, and it has now over 1 million views. If you look for Google and Zaslon, you can find it. But I received a package unannounced, which was a bit strange, and that was on Friday, and the package was from the person who helped me with that article and kind of got me into the online writing space more. And it's something that I'm really happy about, and I know he listens, so I wanted to say thank you for sharing with me the intricacies about like some of like Russian historic covert action and sending me this nice gift that I really appreciate. Hopefully one day I can share it, and I know it sounds a bit weird, but on intelligence leadership and management, a book that Ole talked about in a couple of podcasts ago, Leading Intelligence Analysis, Lessons from the CIA's Analytic Frontlines, from Bruce E. Peace. I've been reading that off and on for the last couple of months as more like a guidebook. It's fantastic, so I can highly recommend that one. And I think I've mentioned my this is more of a guilty pleasure, but that I'm a fan of Japanese mangas. So I'm now on volume 2 of Vagabond, which is loosely based on Musashi, the samurai, wandering samurai. And that's a really good manga. Really, yeah, it looks really cool too. So that's something that I keep on going into. And watching, I think I mentioned this on the last podcast too, but I'm almost done now with it, is Shogun. I know it's been hyped online, but God, it's fantastic. It's so, if you're interested in finding intelligence tradecraft in popular culture, the Shogun is perfect. The intrigue and the running of human assets, it's really depicted really well in that show, and even the use of how covert communications by using pigeons and in a very covert area, which is, yeah, I don't want to spill too much. It's a good show.
I might have a spare few hours tonight, so yeah. I might have a look, but I don't get too hooked because I'll binge, and then I'll
you will binge this. I promise you.
Our season, all yeah. That kind of stuff. No, thank you very much for those recommendations, Ahmed. And
absolutely,
as ever, you know, folks want to reach out to me on LinkedIn, they can do as they have in the recent past. But you know, just to finalize, it's been great seeing how your podcast has developed. It's really testament to your hard work. So
appreciate that.
Bravo, well done, what you're doing for the sector. And you know, and thank you very much for inviting me on again. Thank you.
Thank you for your time and your sage advice. As always, I think you're one of the few and first people that I've seen on LinkedIn sharing information when you were in your previous role and being passionate about helping others. And I've mentioned that in the first podcast, but I will say it again. I think you're one of the few really that inspired me also to do the podcast and talk about it. So yeah, to get compliments from you, it means really a lot. Thank you.
Well, thank you for your kind words. And you know, folks have reached out to me and continue to do so. And you know, I'd encourage anybody, you know, listening, if you're not following Great Dynamics already, please do so. It's a great, great concept, wonderful podcast. And of course, follow Cineline as well. Sure. Please, you know, reach out to me if you're leaving the public sector, if you're a graduate, or if you're a fellow professional that disagrees with everything I've said. Please do get in touch.
I don't think there's many.
I do like speaking to folks in the sector, because we are all still learning. And even in 10, 20 years' time, I'll still be learning. But with that, Ahmed, thank you so much for inviting me on. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. And for everybody listening, thank you for joining the podcast again. And it's been fantastic. And every podcast, we see the responses growing more and more. The one thing, if I had a wish, would be, guys, please review, give us feedback on the podcast, and follow us on YouTube. Try to grow that. Thank you. And again, thank you, Gareth. And see you next time.